At times, Jobs displayed a strange mixture of prickliness and neediness. He usually didn't care one iota what people thought of him. He could cut people off and never care to speak to them again. Yet sometimes he also felt a compulsion to explain himself. So that evening, Emilio received, to his surprise, a phone call from Jobs. "Gee, Gil, I just wanted you to know. I talked to Ed today about this thing, and I really feel bad about it," he said. "I want you to know that I had absolutely nothing to do with this turn of events. It was a decision the board made, but they had asked me for advice and counsel." He told Emilio he respected him for having the highest integrity of anyone I've ever met, and went on to give some unsolicited advice. "Take 6 months off," Jobs told him. "When I got thrown out of Apple, I immediately went back to work, and I regretted it." He offered to be a sounding board if Emilio ever wanted more advice. Emilio was stunned, but managed to mumble a few words of thanks. He turned to his wife and recounted what Jobs said. "In ways, I still like the man, but I don't believe him," he told her. "I was totally taken in by Steve," she said, "and I really feel like an idiot." "Join the crowd," her husband replied. Steve Wozniak, who was himself now an informal advisor to the company, was thrilled that Jobs was coming back. He forgave easily. "It was just what we needed," he said, "because whatever you think of Steve, he knows how to get the magic back." Nor did Jobs's triumph over Emilio surprise him. As he told Wired shortly after it happened, "Gil Emilio meets Steve Jobs, game over." That Monday, Apple's top employees were summoned to the auditorium. Emilio came in looking calm and relaxed. "Well, I'm sad to report that it's time for me to move on," he said. Fred Anderson, who had agreed to be interim CEO, spoke next, and he made it clear that he would be taking his cues from Jobs. Then, exactly 12 years since he had lost power in a July 4th weekend struggle, Jobs walked back on stage at Apple. It immediately became clear that whether or not he wanted to admit it publicly or even to himself, Jobs was going to take control and not be a mere advisor. As soon as he came on stage that day, wearing shorts, sneakers, and a black turtleneck, he got to work reinvigorating his beloved institution. "Okay, tell me what's wrong with this place," he said. There were some murmurings, but Jobs cut them off. "It's the products," he answered. "So what's wrong with the products?" Again, there were a few attempts at an answer, until Jobs broke in to hand down the correct answer. "The products suck," he shouted. "There's no sex in them anymore." Woolard was able to coax Jobs to agree that his role as an advisor would be a very active one. Jobs approved a statement saying that he had agreed to step up my involvement with Apple for up to 90 days, helping them until they hire a new CEO. The clever formulation that Woolard used in his statement was that Jobs was coming back as an advisor leading the team. Jobs took a small office next to the boardroom on the executive floor, conspicuously eschewing Emilio's big corner office. He got involved in all aspects of the business: product design, where to cut, supplier negotiations, and advertising agency review. He believed that he had to stop the hemorrhaging of top Apple employees, and to do so, he wanted to reprice their stock options. Apple stock had dropped so low that the options had become worthless. Jobs wanted to lower the exercise price so they would be valuable again. At the time, that was legally permissible, but it was not considered good corporate practice. On his first Thursday back at Apple, Jobs called for a telephonic board meeting and outlined the problem. The directors balked. They asked for time to do a legal and financial study of what the change would mean. "It has to be done fast," Jobs told them. "We're losing good people." Even his supporter, Ed Woolard, who headed the compensation committee, objected. "At DuPont, we never did such a thing," he said. "You brought me here to fix this thing, and people are the key," Jobs argued. When the board proposed a study that could take 2 months, Jobs exploded. "Are you nuts?" He paused for a long moment of silence, then continued. "Guys, if you don't want to do this, I'm not coming back on Monday, because I've got thousands of key decisions to make that are far more difficult than this. And if you can't throw your support behind this kind of decision, I will fail. So if you can't do this, I'm out of here. And you can blame it on me. You can say Steve wasn't up for the job." The next day, after consulting with the board, Woolard called Jobs back. "We're going to approve this," he said, "but some of the board members don't like it. We feel like you've put a gun to our head." The options for the top team, Jobs had none, were reset at $13.25, which was the price of the stock the day Emilio was ousted. Instead of declaring victory and thanking the board, Jobs continued to seethe at having to answer to a board he didn't respect. "Stop the train. This isn't going to work," he told Woolard. "This company is in shambles, and I don't have time to wet nurse the board. So I need all of you to resign, or else I'm going to resign and not come back on Monday." The one person who could stay, he said, was Woolard. Most members of the board were aghast. Jobs was still refusing to commit himself to coming back full-time or being anything more than an advisor, yet he felt he had the power to force them to leave. The hard truth, however, was that he did have that power over them. They could not afford for him to storm off in a fury, nor was the prospect of remaining an Apple board member very enticing by then. After all they'd been through, most were glad to be let off, Woolard recalled. Once again, the board acquiesced. It made only one request. Would he permit one other director to stay in addition to Woolard? It would help the optics. Jobs assented. "They were an awful board, a terrible board," he later said. "I agreed they could keep Ed Woolard and a guy named Gareth Chang, who turned out to be a zero. He wasn't terrible, just a zero. Woolard, on the other hand, was one of the best board members I've ever seen. He was a prince, one of the most supportive and wise people I've ever met." Among those being asked to resign was Mike Markala, who in 1976, as a young venture capitalist, had visited the Jobs garage, fallen in love with the nascent computer on the workbench, guaranteed a $250,000 line of credit, and become the third partner and one-third owner of the new company. Over the subsequent two decades, he was the one constant on the board, ushering in and out a variety of CEOs. He had supported Jobs at times, but also clashed with him, most notably when he sided with Scully in the showdowns of 1985. With Jobs returning, he knew that it was time for him to leave. Jobs could be cutting and cold, especially toward people who crossed him, but he could also be sentimental about those who had been with him from the early days. Wozniak fell into that favored category, of course, even though they had drifted apart. So did Andy Hertzfeld and a few others from the Macintosh team. In the end, Mike Markala did as well. "I felt deeply betrayed by him, but he was like a father, and I always cared about him," Jobs later recalled. So when the time came to ask him to resign from the Apple board, Jobs drove to Markala's chateau-like mansion in the Woodside Hills to do it personally. As usual, he asked to take a walk, and they strolled the grounds to a redwood grove with a picnic table. "He told me he wanted a new board because he wanted to start fresh," Markala said. He was worried that I might take it poorly, and he was relieved when I didn't. They spent the rest of the time talking about where Apple should focus in the future. Jobs's ambition was to build a company that would endure, and he asked Markkula what the formula for that would be. Markkula replied that lasting companies know how to reinvent themselves. Hewlett-Packard had done that repeatedly. It started as an instrument company, then became a calculator company, then a computer company. Apple has been sidelined by Microsoft in the PC business, Markkula said. You've got to reinvent the company to do some other thing, like other consumer products or devices. You've got to be like a butterfly and have a metamorphosis. Jobs didn't say much, but he agreed. The old board met in late July to ratify the transition. Woolard, who was as genteel as Jobs was prickly, was mildly taken aback when Jobs appeared dressed in jeans and sneakers, and he worried that Jobs might start berating the veteran board members for screwing up. But Jobs merely offered a pleasant, "Hi, everyone." They got down to the business of voting to accept the resignations, elect Jobs to the board, and empower Woolard and Jobs to find new board members. Jobs' first recruit was, not surprisingly, Larry Ellison. He said he would be pleased to join, but he hated attending meetings. Jobs said it would be fine if he came to only half of them. After a while, Ellison was coming to only a third of the meetings. Jobs took a picture of him that had appeared on the cover of Business Week and had it blown up to life size and pasted on a cardboard cutout to put in his chair. Jobs also brought in Bill Campbell, who had run marketing at Apple in the early 1980s and had been caught in the middle of the Scully-Jobs clash. Campbell had ended up sticking with Scully, but he had grown to dislike him so much that Jobs forgave him. Now he was the CEO of Intuit and a walking buddy of Jobs. "We were sitting out in the back of his house," recalled Campbell, who lived only 5 blocks from Jobs in Palo Alto, and he said he was going back to Apple and wanted me on the board. I said, "Holy shit, of course I will do that." Campbell had been a football coach at Columbia, and his great talent, Jobs said, was to get A performances out of B players. At Apple, Jobs told him, he would get to work with A players. Woolard helped bring in Jerry York, who had been the chief financial officer at Chrysler and then IBM. Others were considered and then rejected by Jobs, including Meg Whitman, who was then the manager of Hasbro's Play School division and had been a strategic planner at Disney. In 1998, she became CEO of eBay, and she later ran unsuccessfully for governor of California. Over the years, Jobs would bring in some strong leaders to serve on the Apple board, including Al Gore, Eric Schmidt of Google, Art Levinson of Genentech, Mickey Drexler of The Gap and J. Crew, and Andrea Jung of Avon. But he always made sure they were loyal, sometimes loyal to a fault. Despite their stature, they seemed at times awed or intimidated by Jobs, and they were eager to keep him happy. At one point, he invited Arthur Levitt, the former SEC chairman, to become a board member. Levitt, who bought his first Macintosh in 1984 and was proudly addicted to Apple computers, was thrilled. He was excited to visit Cupertino, where he discussed the role with Jobs. But then Jobs read a speech Levitt had given about corporate governance, which argued that boards should play a strong and independent role, and he telephoned to withdraw the invitation. "Arthur, I don't think you'd be happy on our board, and I think it best if we not invite you," Levitt said Jobs told him. "Frankly, I think some of the issues you raised, while appropriate for some companies, really don't apply to Apple's culture." Levitt later wrote, "I was floored. It's plain to me that Apple's board is not designed to act independently of the CEO." Macworld Boston, August 1997. The staff memo announcing the repricing of Apple's stock options was signed Steve and the executive team, and it soon became public that he was running all of the company's product review meetings. These and other indications that Jobs was now deeply engaged at Apple helped push the stock up from about $13 to $20 during July. It also created a frisson of excitement as the Apple faithful gathered for the August 1997 Macworld in Boston. More than 5,000 showed up hours in advance to cram into the Castle Convention Hall of the Park Plaza Hotel for Jobs' keynote speech. They came to see their returning hero and to find out whether he was really ready to lead them again. Huge cheers erupted when a picture of Jobs from 1984 was flashed on the overhead screen. "Steve, Steve, Steve," the crowd started to chant, even as he was still being introduced. When he finally strode on stage, wearing a black vest, collarless white shirt, jeans, and an impish smile, the screams and flashbulbs rivaled those for any rock star. At first, he punctured the excitement by reminding them of where he officially worked. "I'm Steve Jobs, the chairman and CEO of Pixar," he introduced himself, flashing a slide on screen with that title. Then he explained his role at Apple. "I, like a lot of other people, are pulling together to help Apple get healthy again." But as Jobs paced back and forth across the stage, changing the overhead slides with a clicker in his hand, it was clear that he was now in charge at Apple and was likely to remain so. He delivered a carefully crafted presentation, using no notes, on why Apple's sales had fallen by 30% over the previous 2 years. "There are a lot of great people at Apple, but they're doing the wrong things because the plan has been wrong," he said. "I've found people who can't wait to fall into line behind a good strategy, but there just hasn't been one." The crowd again erupted in yelps, whistles, and cheers. As he spoke, his passion poured forth with increasing intensity, and he began saying "we" and "I" rather than "they" when referring to what Apple would be doing. "I think you still have to think differently to buy an Apple computer," he said. "The people who buy them do think different. They are the creative spirits in this world, and they're out to change the world. We make tools for those kinds of people." When he stressed the word "we" in that sentence, he cupped his hands and tapped his fingers on his chest. And then, in his final peroration, he continued to stress the word "we" as he talked about Apple's future. "We, too, are going to think differently and serve the people who have been buying our products from the beginning. Because a lot of people think they're crazy, but in that craziness, we see genius." During the prolonged standing ovation, people looked at each other in awe and a few wiped tears from their eyes. Jobs had made it very clear that he and the "we" of Apple were one. The Microsoft Pact. The climax of Jobs' August 1997 Macworld appearance was a bombshell announcement, one that made the cover of both Time and Newsweek. Near the end of his speech, he paused for a sip of water and began to talk in more subdued tones. "Apple lives in an ecosystem," he said. "It needs help from other partners. Relationships that are destructive don't help anybody in this industry." For dramatic effect, he paused again and then explained, "I'd like to announce one of our first new partnerships today, a very meaningful one, and that is one with Microsoft." The Microsoft and Apple logos appeared together on the screen as people gasped. Apple and Microsoft had been at war for a decade over a variety of copyright and patent issues, most notably whether Microsoft had stolen the look and feel of Apple's graphical user interface. Just as Jobs was being eased out of Apple in 1985, John Sculley had struck a surrender deal. Microsoft could license the Apple GUI for Windows 1.0, and in return, it would make Excel exclusive to the Mac for up to 2 years. In 1988, after Microsoft came out with Windows 2.0, Apple sued. Sculley contended that the 1985 deal did not apply to Windows 2.0 and that further refinements to Windows, such as copying Bill Atkinson's trick of clipping overlapping windows, had made the infringement more blatant. By 1997, Apple had lost the case and various appeals, but remnants of the litigation and threats of new suits lingered. In addition, President Clinton's Justice Department was preparing a massive antitrust case against Microsoft. Jobs invited the lead prosecutor, Joel Klein, to Palo Alto. "Don't worry about extracting a huge remedy against Microsoft," Jobs told him over coffee. "Instead, simply keep them tied up in litigation." That would allow Apple the opportunity, Jobs explained, to make an end run around Microsoft and start offering competing products. Under Emilio, the showdown had become explosive. Microsoft refused to commit to developing Word and Excel for future Macintosh operating systems, which could have destroyed Apple. In defense of Bill Gates, he was not simply being vindictive. It was understandable that he was reluctant to commit to developing for a future Macintosh operating system when no one, including the ever-changing leadership at Apple, seemed to know what that new operating system would be. Right after Apple bought Next, Emilio and Jobs flew together to visit Microsoft, but Gates had trouble figuring out which of them was in charge. A few days later, he called Jobs privately. "Hey, what the fuck? Am I supposed to put my applications on the Next OS?" Gates asked. Jobs responded by making smart-ass remarks about Gil, Gates recalled, and suggesting that the situation would soon be clarified. When the leadership issue was partly resolved by Emilio's ouster, one of Jobs' first phone calls was to Gates. Jobs recalled, "I called up Bill and said, 'I'm going to turn this thing around.' Bill always had a soft spot for Apple. We got him into the application software business. The first Microsoft apps were Excel and Word for the Mac. So I called him and said, 'I need help.' Microsoft was walking over Apple's patents. I said, 'If we kept up our lawsuits, a few years from now, we could win a $1 billion patent suit. You know it, and I know it. But Apple's not going to survive that long if we're at war. I know that. So let's figure out how to settle this right away. All I need is a commitment that Microsoft will keep developing for the Mac and an investment by Microsoft in Apple, so it has a stake in our success.'" When I recounted to him what Jobs said, Gates agreed it was accurate. "We had a group of people who liked working on the Mac stuff, and we liked the Mac," Gates recalled. He had been negotiating with Emilio for 6 months, and the proposals kept getting longer and more complicated. So Steve comes in and says, "Hey, that deal is too complicated. What I want is a simple deal. I want the commitment, and I want an investment." And so we put that together in just 4 weeks. Gates and his chief financial officer, Greg Maffei, made the trip to Palo Alto to work out the framework for a deal, and then Maffei returned alone the following Sunday to work on the details. When he arrived at Jobs' home, Jobs grabbed 2 bottles of water out of the refrigerator and took Maffei for a walk around the Palo Alto neighborhood. Both men wore shorts, and Jobs walked barefoot. As they sat in front of a Baptist church, Jobs cut to the core issues. "These are the things we care about," he said. a commitment to make software for the Mac, and an investment. Although the negotiations went quickly, the final details were not finished until hours before Jobs's Macworld speech in Boston. He was rehearsing at the Park Plaza Castle when his cell phone rang. "Hi, Bill," he said as his words echoed through the old hall. Then he walked to a corner and spoke in a soft tone so others couldn't hear. The call lasted an hour. Finally, the remaining deal points were resolved. "Bill, thank you for your support of this company," Jobs said as he crouched in his shorts. "I think the world's a better place for it." During his Macworld keynote address, Jobs walked through the details of the Microsoft deal. At first, there were groans and hisses from the faithful. Particularly galling was Jobs's announcement that as part of the peace pact, Apple has decided to make Internet Explorer its default browser on the Macintosh. The audience erupted in boos, and Jobs quickly added, "Since we believe in choice, we're going to be shipping other Internet browsers as well, and the user can, of course, change their default should they choose to." There were some laughs and scattered applause. The audience was beginning to come around, especially when he announced that Microsoft would be investing $150 million in Apple and getting non-voting shares. But the mellower mood was shattered for a moment when Jobs made one of the few visual and public relations gaffes of his onstage career. "I happen to have a special guest with me today, via satellite downlink," he said, and suddenly, Bill Gates's face appeared on the huge screen looming over Jobs and the auditorium. There was a thin smile on Gates's face that flirted with being a smirk. The audience gasped in horror, followed by some boos and catcalls. The scene was such a brutal echo of the 1984 Big Brother ad that you half expected and hoped that an athletic woman would suddenly come running down the aisle and vaporize the screenshot with a well-thrown hammer. But it was all for real, and Gates, unaware of the jeering, began speaking on the satellite link from Microsoft headquarters. "Some of the most exciting work that I've done in my career has been the work that I've done with Steve on the Macintosh," he intoned in his high-pitched sing-song. As he went on to tout the new version of Microsoft Office that was being made for the Macintosh, the audience quieted down and then slowly seemed to accept the new world order. Gates even was able to rouse some applause when he said that the new Mac versions of Word and Excel would be in many ways more advanced than what we've done on the Windows platform. Jobs realized that the image of Gates looming over him and the audience was a mistake. "I wanted him to come to Boston," Jobs later said. "That was my worst and stupidest staging event ever. It was bad because it made me look small, and Apple look small, and as if everything was in Bill's hands." Gates likewise was embarrassed when he saw the videotape of the event. "I didn't know that my face was going to be blown up to looming proportions," he said. Jobs tried to reassure the audience with an impromptu sermon. "If we want to move forward and see Apple healthy again, we have to let go of a few things here," he told the audience. "We have to let go of this notion that for Apple to win, Microsoft has to lose. I think if we want Microsoft Office on the Mac, we better treat the company that puts it out with a little bit of gratitude." The Microsoft announcement, along with Jobs's passionate re-engagement with the company, provided a much-needed jolt for Apple. By the end of the day, its stock had skyrocketed $6.56, or 33%, to close at $26.31, twice the price of the day Emilio resigned. The one-day jump added $830 million to Apple's stock market capitalization. The company was back from the edge of the grave. Chapter 25. Think Different. Jobs as CEO. Here's to the crazy ones. Lee Clow, the creative director at Chiat Day, who had done the great 1984 ad for the launch of the Macintosh, was driving in Los Angeles in early July 1997 when his car phone rang. It was Jobs. "Hi, Lee, this is Steve," he said. "Guess what? Emilio just resigned. Can you come up here?" Apple was going through a review to select a new agency, and Jobs was not impressed by what he had seen. So he wanted Clow and his firm, by then called TBWA Chiat Day, to compete for the business. "We have to prove that Apple is still alive," Jobs said, "and that it still stands for something special." Clow said that he didn't pitch for accounts. "You know our work," he said, but Jobs begged him. It would be hard to reject all the others that were making pitches, including BBDO and Arnold Worldwide, and bring back an old crony, as Jobs put it. Clow agreed to fly up to Cupertino with something they could show. Recounting the scene years later, Jobs started to cry. "This chokes me up. This really chokes me up. It was so clear that Lee loved Apple so much. Here was the best guy in advertising, and he hadn't pitched in 10 years. Yet here he was, and he was pitching his heart out, because he loved Apple as much as we did. He and his team had come up with this brilliant idea, Think Different, and it was 10 times better than anything the other agencies showed. It choked me up, and it still makes me cry to think about it, both the fact that Lee cared so much and also how brilliant his Think Different idea was. Every once in a while, I find myself in the presence of purity, purity of spirit and love, and I always cry. It always just reaches in and grabs me. That was one of those moments. There was a purity about that I will never forget. I cried in my office as he was showing me the idea, and I still cry when I think about it." Jobs and Clow agreed that Apple was one of the great brands of the world, probably in the top 5 based on emotional appeal, but they needed to remind folks what was distinctive about it. So they wanted a brand image campaign, not a set of advertisements featuring products. It was designed to celebrate not what the computers could do, but what creative people could do with the computers. This wasn't about processor speed or memory, Jobs recalled. It was about creativity. It was directed not only at potential customers, but also at Apple's own employees. "We at Apple had forgotten who we were. One way to remember who you are is to remember who your heroes are." That was the genesis of that campaign. Clow and his team tried a variety of approaches that praised the crazy ones who think different. They did one video with the Seals song, "Crazy. We're never going to survive unless we get a little crazy," but couldn't get the rights to it. Then they tried versions using a recording of Robert Frost reading "The Road Not Taken" and of Robin Williams' speeches from Dead Poets Society. Eventually, they decided they needed to write their own text. Their draft began, "Here's to the crazy ones." Jobs was as demanding as ever. When Clow's team flew up with a version of the text, he exploded at the young copywriter. "This is shit," he yelled. "It's advertising agency shit, and I hate it." It was the first time the young copywriter had met Jobs, and he stood there mute. He never went back. But those who could stand up to Jobs, including Clow and his teammates Ken Siegel and Craig Tanimoto, were able to work with him to create a tone poem that he liked. In its original 60-second version, it read, "Here's to the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels, the troublemakers, the round pegs in the square holes, the ones who see things differently. They're not fond of rules, and they have no respect for the status quo. You can quote them, disagree with them, glorify or vilify them. About the only thing you can't do is ignore them. because they change things. They push the human race forward, and while some may see them as the crazy ones, we see genius. Because the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do. Jobs, who could identify with each of those sentiments, wrote some of the lines himself, including, "They push the human race forward." By the time of the Boston Macworld in early August, they had produced a rough version. They agreed it was not ready, but Jobs used the concepts and the "think different" phrase in his keynote speech there. "There's a germ of a brilliant idea there," he said at the time. "Apple is about people who think outside the box, who want to use computers to help them change the world." They debated the grammatical issue. If "different" was supposed to modify the verb "think," it should be an adverb, as in "think differently." But Jobs insisted that he wanted "different" to be used as a noun, as in "think victory" or "think beauty." Also, it echoed colloquial use, as in "think big." Jobs later explained, "We discussed whether it was correct before we ran it. It's grammatical, if you think about what we're trying to say. It's not think the same, it's think different. Think a little different, think a lot different, think different. Think differently wouldn't hit the meaning for me." In order to evoke the spirit of Dead Poets Society, Clow and Jobs wanted to get Robin Williams to read the narration. His agent said that Williams didn't do ads, so Jobs tried to call him directly. He got through to Williams's wife, who would not let him talk to the actor because she knew how persuasive he could be. They also considered Maya Angelou and Tom Hanks. At a fundraising dinner featuring Bill Clinton that fall, Jobs pulled the president aside and asked him to telephone Hanks to talk him into it, but the president pocket vetoed the request. They ended up with Richard Dreyfuss, who was a dedicated Apple fan. In addition to the television commercials, they created one of the most memorable print campaigns in history. Each ad featured a black and white portrait of an iconic historical figure with just the Apple logo and the words, "Think different" in the corner. Making it particularly engaging was that the faces were not captioned. Some of them, Einstein, Gandhi, Lenin, Dylan, Picasso, Edison, Chaplin, King, were easy to identify. But others caused people to pause, puzzle, and maybe ask a friend to put a name to the face. Martha Graham, Ansel Adams, Richard Feynman, Maria Callas, Frank Lloyd Wright, James Watson, Amelia Earhart. Most were Jobs' personal heroes. They tended to be creative people who had taken risks, defied failure, and bet their career on doing things in a different way. A photography buff, he became involved in making sure they had the perfect iconic portraits. "This is not the right picture of Gandhi," he erupted to Clow at one point. Clow explained that the famous Margaret Bourke White photograph of Gandhi at the spinning wheel was owned by Time Life Pictures and was not available for commercial use. So Jobs called Norman Perlstein, the editor-in-chief of Time Incorporated, and badgered him into making an exception. He called Eunice Shriver to convince her family to release a picture that he loved of her brother Bobby Kennedy touring Appalachia, and he talked to Jim Henson's children personally to get the right shot of the late Muppeteer. He likewise called Yoko Ono for a picture of her late husband, John Lennon. She sent him one, but it was not Jobs's favorite. "Before it ran, I was in New York, and I went to this small Japanese restaurant that I love and let her know I would be there," he recalled. When he arrived, she came over to his table. "This is a better one," she said, handing him an envelope. "I thought I would see you, so I had this with me." It was the classic photo of her and John in bed together, holding flowers, and it was the one that Apple ended up using. I can see why John fell in love with her, Jobs recalled. The narration by Richard Dreyfuss worked well, but Lee Clow had another idea. What if Jobs did the voiceover himself? You really believe this, Clow told him. You should do it. So Jobs sat in a studio, did a few takes, and soon produced a voice track that everyone liked. The idea was that if they used it, they would not tell people who was speaking the words, just as they didn't caption the iconic pictures. Eventually, people would figure out it was Jobs. This will be really powerful to have it in your voice, Clow argued. It will be a way to reclaim the brand. Jobs couldn't decide whether to use the version with his voice or to stick with Dreyfuss. Finally, the night came when they had to ship the ad. It was due to air, appropriately enough, on the television premiere of Toy Story. As was often the case, Jobs did not like to be forced to make a decision. He told Clow to ship both versions. This would give him until the morning to decide. When morning came, Jobs called and told them to use the Dreyfuss version. If we use my voice, when people find out, they will say it's about me, he told Clow. It's not. It's about Apple. Ever since he left the Apple commune, Jobs had defined himself, and by extension Apple, as a child of the counterculture. In ads such as Think Different in 1984, he positioned the Apple brand so that it reaffirmed his own rebel streak, even after he became a billionaire, and it allowed other baby boomers and their kids to do the same. From when I first met him as a young guy, he's had the greatest intuition of the impact he wants his brand to have on people, said Clow. Very few other companies or corporate leaders, perhaps none, could have gotten away with the brilliant audacity of associating their brand with Gandhi, Einstein, Picasso, and the Dalai Lama. Jobs was able to encourage people to define themselves as anti-corporate, creative, innovative rebels simply by the computer they used. Steve created the only lifestyle brand in the tech industry, Larry Ellison said. There are cars people are proud to have, Porsche, Ferrari, Prius, because what I drive says something about me. People feel the same way about an Apple product. Starting with the Think Different campaign, and continuing through the rest of his years at Apple, Jobs held a freewheeling 3-hour meeting every Wednesday afternoon with his top agency, marketing, and communications people to kick around messaging strategy. There's not a CEO on the planet who deals with marketing the way Steve does, said Clow. Every Wednesday, he approves each new commercial, print ad, and billboard. At the end of the meeting, he would often take Clow and his two agency colleagues, Duncan Milner and James Vincent, to Apple's closely guarded design studio to see what products were in the works. He gets very passionate and emotional when he shows us what's in development, said Vincent. By sharing with his marketing gurus his passion for the products as they were being created, he was able to ensure that almost every ad they produced was infused with his emotion. CEO. As he was finishing work on the Think Different ad, Jobs did some different thinking of his own. He decided that he would officially take over running the company, at least on a temporary basis. He had been the de facto leader since Emilio's ouster 10 weeks earlier, but only as an advisor. Fred Anderson had the titular role of interim CEO. On September 16, 1997, Jobs announced that he would take over that title, which inevitably got abbreviated as CEO. His commitment was tentative. He took no salary and signed no contract. But he was not tentative in his actions. He was in charge, and he did not rule by consensus. That week, he gathered his top managers and staff in the Apple Auditorium for a rally, followed by a picnic featuring beer and vegan food, to celebrate his new role and the company's new ads. He was wearing shorts, was walking around the campus barefoot, and had a stubble of beard. "I've been back about 10 weeks, working really hard," he said, looking tired but deeply determined. "What we're trying to do is not highfalutin. We're trying to get back to the basics of great products, great marketing, and great distribution. Apple has drifted away from doing the basics really well." For a few more weeks, Jobs and the board kept looking for a permanent CEO. Various names surfaced: George M.C. Fisher of Kodak, Sam Palmisano at IBM, Ed Zander at Sun Microsystems, but most of the candidates were understandably reluctant to consider becoming CEO if Jobs was going to remain an active board member. The San Francisco Chronicle reported that Zander declined to be considered because he didn't want Steve looking over his shoulder, second-guessing him on every decision. At one point, Jobs and Ellison pulled a prank on a clueless computer consultant who was campaigning for the job. They sent him an email saying that he had been selected, which caused both amusement and embarrassment when stories appeared in the papers that they were just toying with him. By December, it had become clear that Jobs's iCEO status had evolved from interim to indefinite. As Jobs continued to run the company, the board quietly deactivated its search. "I went back to Apple and tried to hire a CEO, with the help of a recruiting agency, for almost 4 months," he recalled. "But they didn't produce the right people. That's why I finally stayed. Apple was in no shape to attract anybody good." The problem Jobs faced was that running two companies was brutal. Looking back on it, he traced his health problems back to those days. "It was rough, really rough, the worst time in my life. I had a young family, I had Pixar, I would go to work at 7 a.m. and I'd get back at 9 at night, and the kids would be in bed. And I couldn't speak, I literally couldn't, I was so exhausted. I couldn't speak to Laureen, all I could do was watch a half hour of TV and vegetate. It got close to killing me. I was driving up to Pixar and down to Apple in a black Porsche convertible, and I started to get kidney stones. I would rush to the hospital, and the hospital would give me a shot of Demerol in the butt, and eventually I would pass it." Despite the grueling schedule, the more that Jobs immersed himself in Apple, the more he realized that he would not be able to walk away. When Michael Dell was asked at a computer trade show in October 1997 what he would do if he were Steve Jobs and taking over Apple, he replied, "I'd shut it down and give the money back to the shareholders." Jobs fired off an email to Dell. "CEOs are supposed to have class," it said. "I can see that isn't an opinion you hold." Jobs liked to stoke up rivalries as a way to rally his team. He had done so with IBM and Microsoft, and he did so with Dell. When he called together his managers to institute a build-to-order system for manufacturing and distribution, Jobs used as a backdrop a blown-up picture of Michael Dell with a target on his face. "We're coming after you, buddy," he said to cheers from his troops. One of his motivating passions was to build a lasting company. At age 12, when he got a summer job at Hewlett-Packard, he learned that a properly run company could spawn innovation far more than any single creative individual. "I discovered that the best innovation is sometimes the company, the way you organize a company," he recalled. "The whole notion of how you build a company is fascinating. When I got the chance to come back to Apple, I realized that I would be useless without the company, and that's why I decided to stay and rebuild it." Killing the clones. One of the great debates about Apple was whether it should have licensed its operating system more aggressively to other computer makers, the way Microsoft licensed Windows. Wozniak had favored that approach from the beginning. We had the most beautiful operating system, he said, but to get it, you had to buy our hardware at twice the price. That was a mistake. What we should have done was calculate an appropriate price to license the operating system. Alan Kay, the star of Xerox PARC, who came to Apple as a fellow in 1984, also fought hard for licensing the Mac OS software. Software people are always multi-platform because you want to run on everything, he recalled, and that was a huge battle, probably the largest battle I lost at Apple. Bill Gates, who was building a fortune by licensing Microsoft's operating system, had urged Apple to do the same in 1985, just as Jobs was being eased out. Gates believed that even if Apple took away some of Microsoft's operating system customers, Microsoft could make money by creating versions of its application software, such as Word and Excel, for the users of the Macintosh and its clones. I was trying to do everything to get them to be a strong licensor, he recalled. He sent a formal memo to Scully, making the case. The industry has reached the point where it is now impossible for Apple to create a standard out of their innovative technology without support from, and the resulting credibility of, other personal computer manufacturers, he argued. Apple should license Macintosh technology to 3 to 5 significant manufacturers for the development of Mac compatibles. Gates got no reply, so he wrote a second memo suggesting some companies that would be good at cloning the Mac, and he added, I want to help in any way I can with the licensing. Please give me a call. Apple resisted licensing out the Macintosh operating system until 1994, when CEO Michael Spindler allowed two small companies, Power Computing and Radius, to make Macintosh clones. When Gil Amelio took over in 1996, he added Motorola to the list. It turned out to be a dubious business strategy. Apple got an $80 licensing fee for each computer sold, but instead of expanding the market, the cloners cannibalized the sales of Apple's own high-end computers, on which it made up to $500 in profit. Jobs's objections to the cloning program were not just economic, however. He had an inbred aversion to it. One of his core principles was that hardware and software should be tightly integrated. He loved to control all aspects of his life, and the only way to do that with computers was to take responsibility for the user experience from end to end. So upon his return to Apple, he made killing the Macintosh clones a priority. When a new version of the Mac operating system shipped in July 1997, weeks after he had helped oust Amelio, Jobs did not allow the clone makers to upgrade to it. The head of Power Computing, Stephen King Kong, organized pro-cloning protests when Jobs appeared at Boston Macworld that August and publicly warned that the Macintosh OS would die if Jobs declined to keep licensing it out. If the platform goes closed, it is over, Kong said. Total destruction. Closed is the kiss of death. Jobs disagreed. He telephoned Ed Wooler to say he was getting Apple out of the licensing business. The board acquiesced, and in September he reached a deal to pay Power Computing $100 million to relinquish its license and give Apple access to its database of customers. He soon terminated the licenses of the other cloners as well. It was the dumbest thing in the world to let companies making crappier hardware use our operating system and cut into our sales, he later said. Product line review. One of Jobs' great strengths was knowing how to focus. Deciding what not to do is as important as deciding what to do, he said. That's true for companies, and it's true for products. He went to work applying this principle as soon as he returned to Apple. One day he was walking the halls and ran into a young Wharton School graduate who had been Amelio's assistant, who said he was wrapping up his work. Well, good, because I need someone to do grunt work, Jobs told him. His new role was to take notes as Jobs met with the dozens of product teams at Apple, asked them to explain what they were doing, and forced them to justify going ahead with their products or projects. He also enlisted a friend, Phil Schiller, who had worked at Apple but was then at the graphics software company Macromedia. Steve would summon the teams into the boardroom, which seats 20, and they would come with 30 people and try to show PowerPoints, which Steve didn't want to see, Schiller recalled. One of the first things Jobs did during the product review process was ban PowerPoints. I hate the way people use slide presentations instead of thinking, Jobs later recalled. People would confront a problem by creating a presentation. I wanted them to engage, to hash things out at the table, rather than show a bunch of slides. People who know what they're talking about don't need PowerPoint. The product review revealed how unfocused Apple had become. The company was churning out multiple versions of each product because of bureaucratic momentum and to satisfy the whims of retailers. It was insanity, Schiller recalled. Tons of products, most of them crap, done by deluded teams. Apple had a dozen versions of the Macintosh, each with a different confusing number, ranging from 1400 to 9600. I had people explaining this to me for 3 weeks, Jobs said. I couldn't figure it out. He finally began asking simple questions like, which ones do I tell my friends to buy? When he couldn't get simple answers, he began slashing away at models and products. Soon he had cut 70% of them. You are bright people, he told one group. You shouldn't be wasting your time on such crappy products. Many of the engineers were infuriated at his slash-and-burn tactics, which resulted in massive layoffs. But Jobs later claimed that the good engineers, including some whose projects were killed, were appreciative. He told one staff meeting in September 1997, I came out of the meeting with people who had just gotten their products canceled, and they were 3 feet off the ground with excitement because they finally understood where in the heck we were going. After a few weeks, Jobs finally had enough. Stop, he shouted at one big product strategy session. This is crazy. He grabbed a magic marker, padded to a whiteboard, and drew a horizontal and vertical line to make a 4-squared chart. Here's what we need, he continued. Atop the two columns, he wrote Consumer and Pro. He labeled the two rows Desktop and Portable. Their job, he said, was to make 4 great products, one for each quadrant. The room was in dumb silence, Schiller recalled. There was also a stunned silence when Jobs presented the plan to the September meeting of the Apple board. Gil had been urging us to approve more and more products every meeting, Woolard recalled. He kept saying, we need more products. Steve came in and said, we needed fewer. He drew a matrix with 4 quadrants and said that this was where we should focus. At first, the board pushed back. It was a risk, Jobs was told. I can make it work, he replied. The board never voted on the new strategy. Jobs was in charge, and he forged ahead. The result was that the Apple engineers and managers suddenly became sharply focused on just 4 areas. For the professional desktop quadrant, they would work on making the Power Macintosh G3. For the professional portable, there would be the PowerBook G3. For the consumer desktop, work would begin on what became the iMac. And for the consumer portable, they would focus on what would become the iBook. The i, Jobs later explained, was to emphasize that the devices would be seamlessly integrated with the Internet. Apple's sharper focus meant getting the company out of other businesses, such as printers and servers. In 1997, Apple was selling StyleWriter color printers that were basically a version of the Hewlett-Packard DeskJet. HP made most of its money by selling the ink cartridges. "I don't understand," Jobs said at the product review meeting. "You're going to ship 1 million and not make money on these? This is nuts." He left the room and called the head of HP. "Let's tear up our arrangement," Jobs proposed, "and we will get out of the printer business and just let you do it." Then he came back to the boardroom and announced the decision. "Steve looked at the situation and instantly knew we needed to get outside of the box," Schiller recalled. The most visible decision he made was to kill, once and for all, the Newton, the personal digital assistant with the almost good handwriting recognition system. Jobs hated it because it was Scully's pet project, because it didn't work perfectly, and because he had an aversion to stylus devices. He had tried to get Emilio to kill it early in 1997 and succeeded only in convincing him to try to spin off the division. By late 1997, when Jobs did his product reviews, it was still around. He later described his thinking. "If Apple had been in a less precarious situation, I would have drilled down myself to figure out how to make it work. I didn't trust the people running it. My gut was that there was some really good technology, but it was fucked up by mismanagement. By shutting it down, I freed up some good engineers who could work on new mobile devices. And eventually, we got it right when we moved on to iPhones and the iPad." This ability to focus saved Apple. In his first year back, Jobs laid off more than 3,000 people, which salvaged the company's balance sheets. For the fiscal year that ended when Jobs became interim CEO in September 1997, Apple lost $1.04 billion. "We were less than 90 days from being insolvent," he recalled. At the January 1998 San Francisco Macworld, Jobs took the stage where Emilio had bombed a year earlier. He sported a full beard and a leather jacket as he touted the new product strategy. And for the first time, he ended the presentation with a phrase that he would make his signature coda. "Oh, and one more thing." This time, the one more thing was, "Think profit." When he said those words, the crowd erupted in applause. After 2 years of staggering losses, Apple had enjoyed a profitable quarter, making $45 million. For the full fiscal year of 1998, it would turn in a $309 million profit. Jobs was back, and so was Apple. Chapter 26, Design Principles. The Studio of Jobs and Ive. Johnny Ive. When Jobs gathered his top management for a pep talk just after he became iCEO in September 1997, sitting in the audience was a sensitive and passionate 30-year-old Brit who was head of the company's design team. Jonathan Ive, known to all as Johnny, was planning to quit. He was sick of the company's focus on profit maximization rather than product design. Jobs's talk led him to reconsider. "I remember very clearly Steve announcing that our goal is not just to make money, but to make great products," Ive recalled. "The decisions you make based on that philosophy are fundamentally different from the ones we had been making at Apple." Ive and Jobs would soon forge a bond that would lead to the greatest industrial design collaboration of their era. Ive grew up in Chingford, a town on the northeast edge of London. His father was a silversmith who taught at the local college. "He's a fantastic craftsman," Ive recalled. "His Christmas gift to me would be one day of his time in his college workshop during the Christmas break when no one else was there, helping me make whatever I dreamed up." The only condition was that Johnny had to draw by hand what they planned to make. "I always understood the beauty of things made by hand. I came to realize that what was really important was the care that was put into it. What I really despise is when I sense some carelessness in a product. I've enrolled in Newcastle Polytechnic and spent his spare time and summers working at a design consultancy. One of his creations was a pen with a little ball on top that was fun to fiddle with. It helped give the owner a playful, emotional connection to the pen. For his thesis, he designed a microphone and earpiece in purest white plastic to communicate with hearing-impaired kids. His flat was filled with foam models he had made to help him perfect the design. He also designed an ATM machine and a curved phone, both of which won awards from the Royal Society of Arts. Unlike some designers, he didn't just make beautiful sketches. He also focused on how the engineering and inner components would work. He had an epiphany in college when he was able to design on a Macintosh. I discovered the Mac and felt I had a connection with the people who were making this product, he recalled. I suddenly understood what a company was or was supposed to be. After graduation, I've helped to build a design firm in London, Tangerine, which got a consulting contract with Apple. In 1992, he moved to Cupertino to take a job in the Apple design department. He became the head of the department in 1996, the year before Jobs returned, but wasn't happy. Emilio had little appreciation for design. There wasn't that feeling of putting care into a product because we were trying to maximize the money we made, Ives said. All they wanted from us designers was a model of what something was supposed to look like on the outside, and then engineers would make it as cheap as possible. I was about to quit. When Jobs took over and gave his pep talk, Ives decided to stick around. But Jobs at first looked around for a world-class designer from the outside. He talked to Richard Sapper, who designed the IBM ThinkPad, and Giorgetto Giugiaro, who designed the Ferrari 250 and the Maserati Ghibli. But then he took a tour of Apple's design studio and bonded with the affable, eager, and very earnest Ive. We discussed approaches to forms and materials, Ive recalled. We were on the same wavelength. I suddenly understood why I loved the company. Ive reported, at least initially, to John Rubinstein, whom Jobs had brought in to head the hardware division, but Ive developed a direct and unusually strong relationship with Jobs. They began to have lunch together regularly, and Jobs would end his day by dropping by Ive's design studio for a chat. Johnny had a special status, said Lorene Powell. He would come by our house, and our families became close. Steve is never intentionally wounding to him. Most people in Steve's life are replaceable, but not Johnny. Jobs described to me his respect for Ive. The difference that Johnny has made, not only at Apple, but in the world, is huge. He is a wickedly intelligent person in all ways. He understands business concepts, marketing concepts. He picks stuff up just like that. Click. He understands what we do at our core better than anyone. If I had a spiritual partner at Apple, it's Johnny. Johnny and I think up most of the products together and then pull others in and say, hey, what do you think about this? He gets the big picture as well as the most infinitesimal details about each product. And he understands that Apple is a product company. He's not just a designer. That's why he works directly for me. He has more operational power than anyone else at Apple except me. There's no one who can tell him what to do or to butt out. That's the way I set it up. Like most designers, I've enjoyed analyzing the philosophy and the step-by-step thinking that went into a particular design. For Jobs, the process was more intuitive. He would point to models and sketches he liked and dump on the ones he didn't. Ive would then take the cues and develop the concepts Jobs blessed. Ive was a fan of the German industrial designer, Dieter Rams, who worked for the electronics firm Braun. Rams preached the gospel of less but better. Venega abba bessa. And likewise, Jobs and Ive wrestled with each new design to see how much they could simplify it. Ever since Apple's first brochure proclaimed, "Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication," Jobs had aimed for the simplicity that comes from conquering complexities, not ignoring them. "It takes a lot of hard work," he said, "to make something simple, to truly understand the underlying challenges and come up with elegant solutions." In Ive, Jobs met his soulmate in the quest for true rather than surface simplicity. Sitting in his design studio, Ive described his philosophy. "Why do we assume that simple is good? Because with physical products, we have to feel we can dominate them. As you bring order to complexity, you find a way to make the product defer to you. Simplicity isn't just a visual style. It's not just minimalism or the absence of clutter. It involves digging through the depth of the complexity. To be truly simple, you have to go really deep. For example, to have no screws on something, you can end up having a product that is so convoluted and so complex. The better way is to go deeper with the simplicity, to understand everything about it and how it's manufactured. You have to deeply understand the essence of a product in order to be able to get rid of the parts that are not essential." That was the fundamental principle Jobs and Ive shared. Design was not just about what a product looked like on the surface. It had to reflect the product's essence. In most people's vocabularies, design means veneer, Jobs told Fortune shortly after retaking the reins at Apple. "But to me, nothing could be further from the meaning of design. Design is the fundamental soul of a man-made creation that ends up expressing itself in successive outer layers." As a result, the process of designing a product at Apple was integrally related to how it would be engineered and manufactured. Ive described one of Apple's Power Macs. "We wanted to get rid of anything other than what was absolutely essential," he said. "To do so required total collaboration between the designers, the product developers, the engineers, and the manufacturing team. We kept going back to the beginning again and again. Do we need that part? Can we get it to perform the function of the other four parts?" The connection between the design of a product, its essence, and its manufacturing was illustrated for Jobs and Ive when they were traveling in France and went into a kitchen supply store. Ive picked up a knife he admired, but then put it down in disappointment. Jobs did the same. "We both noticed a tiny bit of glue between the handle and the blade," Ive recalled. They talked about how the knife's good design had been ruined by the way it was manufactured. "We don't like to think of our knives as being glued together," Ive said. "Steve and I care about things like that, which ruin the purity and detract from the essence of something like a utensil, and we think alike about how products should be made to look pure and seamless." At most other companies, engineering tends to drive design. The engineers set forth their specifications and requirements, and the designers then come up with cases and shells that will accommodate them. For Jobs, the process tended to work the other way. In the early days of Apple, Jobs had approved the design of the case of the original Macintosh, and the engineers had to make their boards and components fit. After he was forced out, the process at Apple reverted to being engineer-driven. Before Steve came back, engineers would say, "Here are the guts, processor, hard drive," and then it would go to the designers to put it in a box, said Apple's marketing chief, Phil Schiller. "When you do it that way, you come up with awful products." But when Jobs returned and forged his bond with Ive, the balance was again tilted toward the designers. "Steve kept impressing on us that the design was integral to what would make us great," said Schiller. Design once again dictated the engineering, not just vice versa. On occasion, this could backfire. such as when Jobs and I've insisted on using a solid piece of brushed aluminum for the edge of the iPhone 4, even when the engineers worried that it would compromise the antenna. But usually, the distinctiveness of its designs for the iMac, the iPod, the iPhone, and the iPad would set Apple apart and lead to its triumphs in the years after Jobs returned.